Okay, how about now? Let's see. Good evening, friends. Welcome to the Journey School. And it's good to be together and to see each of you here tonight. I'm subbing and filling in for our abbess, Marianne, who is enjoying time with family. And we hold her in our heart and wish her and her family most wonderful days. So I've lit the Christ candle behind me, and we begin our class with a wish to be here now. The subject of our class tonight is the gift of the eternal now, this moment. And so we do so with the vertical awareness from above to below in the name of the God the transcendent, God immanent, and God omnipresent, the holy living trinity of love. We'll begin our time as normal with a brief opening prayer and a time of Lectio Divina. And so I invite you just to breathe deeply and to sit comfortably as we enter into our time of prayer. I will lead us with our opening prayer and invite you to recognize that each of us are invited to participate fully as much as we possibly can, to be present to one another through this extraordinary medium of the internet and the age of presence without being physically present. And how each of us contributes to the whole field of our attention by our effort, by being present to one another. So I invite you to close your eyes and, with the gift of your awareness in your body and in your heart and in your mind, to wish to enter into that place of quiet and stillness of being, that place of eminent trust and receptivity to higher influences. The power emanating from the spirit through the circle of conscious humanity and the many ideas of the work and the wisdom of the scriptures. And so we prepare ourselves with back upright, with heart open, and mind in directed attention. With eyes closed, let us breathe in deeply. I breathe in to all and every most hidden part of my being, all my being. Everything. I breathe into everything that might be hurting, everything that seems dimmed and dark from spirit, everything that might feel harsh or shamed, maimed or damaged or diseased. Any part in me that feels unforgiving or unforgivable. Any place in me that bears resentment and holds tightly to resistance. Any part in me that is apathetic, mechanical. Anything in me that is holding back being present to this moment. And I hold it as an offering, lifting it up to the presence of God. To transubstantiate it in faith, in hope, and in love in my being and in the beings of my fellow brothers and sisters of this school. I see my life and I see our community as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved. I see it now in the light of God. And we do this now on behalf of everyone and everything. And everywhere. For all who are suffering in famine or disease or war, we breathe out to them and to breathe in to us this healing light into the world, all worlds. And we reaffirm this deep truth. I am, I wish, I can work. And so let us hand over the complexities of the day that has passed, knowing that even they are gifts. We hand over the plans for tomorrow and concerns awaiting us, knowing that they will be addressed. We hand over the anxieties and small fears of the heart, knowing they are known. We lay down our constructed lives in order to yield and consent to the divine human life emerging in each of us in this present now. And so I stand unencumbered before God and one another. Awake now to the victory of consciously chosen love, or the fears of separation and the lies that lead us to division. We have confidence in the gift of wisdom and the grace that draws us into the awareness of this moment. Lord, have mercy upon each of us and bless our time of study together. Amen. Remaining in that place of quiet, I invite you now to listen for a word of wisdom or insight of God's Spirit to you in our Lectio Divina reading, and also the image, gazing upon it as a means of grace, of a Visio Divina, to see which influences arise and meet you tonight in our time together. I'll read the passage three times with silence in between. For everything, there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. We live under the law of time with its tentacles related to life and death, growth and decay, cause and effect, each of us connected to possibility and destiny. There can come a time when our eyes are opened and we come to realize that mercy is infinite. We need only await it with confidence and receive it with gratitude. For mercy imposes no conditions. And lo, everything we have chosen has been granted to us, and everything we have rejected has also been granted. Yes, we get back even what we rejected. For mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and bliss shall kiss one another. For everything, there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. We live under the law of time, with its tentacles related to life and death, growth and decay, cause and effect, each of us connected to possibility and destiny. There can come a time when our eyes are opened and we come to realize that mercy is infinite. We need only await it with confidence and receive it with gratitude, for mercy imposes no conditions. And lo, everything we have chosen has been granted to us, and everything we rejected has also been granted. Yes, we get back even what we rejected, for mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and bliss shall kiss one another. For everything there is a season, and a time for every purpose under heaven. We live under the law of time with its tentacles, related to life and death, growth and decay, cause and effect. Each of us connected to possibility and destiny. There can come a time when our lives, our eyes are opened, and we come to realize that mercy is infinite. We need only await it with confidence and receive it with gratitude. For mercy imposes no conditions. And lo, everything we have chosen has been granted to us, and everything we rejected has also been granted. Yes, we get back even what we rejected. For mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and bliss shall kiss one another. I now invite you to share what you heard from that reading or what spoke to you about that image. And I invite you to briefly share what you heard. Carolyn, please.
Hi, Peter. Hi, everybody. I saw the image is what stood out for me. And it just glowed with the tentacles coming down through the aqua dots, which for me seemed to be such a symbol of all of those things that feel so observable to us, life and death and growth and decay and cause and effect. And those flowed into the triangle, which feels like the Trinity to me. And it just lights up with a golden glow. And I so love the quote from Babette's Feast. And that golden glow looks just like truth and mercy and truth have met, and righteousness and bliss shall kiss. It was just wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn, for sharing. Meaningful. Tamara or Martin, please.
Like Carolyn, I saw the image is something I could stare at for a while. It's almost like, well, how am I going to self-remember today? I think I'll just go look at that image. But the Carolyn mentioned the tentacles. I see that as spirit and matter together, and the two coexist, and one can't be without the other. And just this beautiful harmony. the squareness of the particles and the tentacleness of the spirit. But then that background, which appeared to be like a pinnacle of some sort, it really came to me as what I can see and what I can't see. And the you know, so you can see a quarter of it, but you can't see three quarters of it. And that's maybe where that mercy of that unconditional mercy is what perhaps most of the time I can't understand because it's invisible to me. Anyway, look more and find more. So thank you.
Right. Thank you, Martin. Beautiful sharing. David, please.
Yes, good evening. Wonderful reading. The section that caught my attention was the piece about mercy in the middle there of how it's infinite. Mercy is infinite. And I was kind of stuck on pondering the line that said, you know, we only have to await it with confidence and receive it with gratitude, and that it imposes no conditions. And I thought, you know, that it's such a wonderful idea to know that, and yet there are so many times when I don't have that confidence or I don't receive it with gratitude, and it feels like there are conditions, but you know, I recognize that's, you know, personality that's imposing conditions. And I also know that there are laws, right, that operate in our universe and in our being. And as I am, you know, working and tuning into the beauty and the grace of these laws, then I come closer and closer, I think, to really experiencing that infinite, no condition mercy more and more. Thank you.
That's lovely. Thank you, David. May it be so. And thank you for sharing that witness on your journey. Jack or Jackie, please. What did you hear in this passage or see in the image?
My arm. Hi, I can hardly see. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I actually was not going to share, but I've got to say that the image this week almost immediately struck me when I first saw it as our movements class, actually, as seen from above, exactly
six
files and six rows, 30 people at the beginning. There are 30 blue dots. And when you zoom in on each dot, they're in a circle that is living time, as Nicole defined that, an unending circle. And the tentacles from the reading are light. It's light coming through this room, joining each of us in this process of learning how to do our own work, but also to work together, second line and first line work. And it's extraordinary. Marianne comes to our movements every week, and it's the image I think she has the opportunity to see from a higher viewpoint of the entire group and the absolute magic of what's happening there. And I see the Enneagram, the image of the Enneagram and the mark as well, in the overview, the circle and the triangle. And that's accurate because in the movements, we go through the Enneagram file by file and row by row. So I was so blessed this week with this image. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for sharing and making that connection with the movements. I don't know if everyone is aware of how the movements are structured, but it is beautiful in harmony movement of the group. Thank you, Jack and Jackie. We have time for one or two more shares if you wish to share what you heard or what you saw in the image. Melba, please.
Hi, everybody. What I felt the essence of the whole poem, and I had memory of that mercy, the infinite mercy, and that I remembered I've died a couple of times in my life. And both experiences were actually wonderful. The music and the light that I saw as energy leaving the planet. And then I returned. And I remember opening my eyes and on one hand feeling really grateful and then kind of disappointed because I was having such a like awesome energetic time. I didn't realize I had passed away. And as I read the poem and I looked over to the image, I thought it was uncanny because the first thing I thought about was the movements.
Yeah.
And how everything about our movements is, you know, making connection with God, really the vertical. And there have been times in the movement that I have felt God and I could feel the essence of the group. I've actually had like really beautiful time. I just started learning, but I noticed that I'm learning in a way that I've never learned before. Mm-hmm. Not a competition or, you know, a good or bad. It's more of I'm here. I'm present. I'm game. And the time just flies.
Thank you, Melba.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing a beautiful connection with the movements and your death experiences. We'll conclude with Rachel, please. Briefly, if you don't mind, Rachel.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. In this moment with the reading, I feel unbelievably struck and comforted by mercy holds no conditions. That brings me just so much right now. And that means that I don't have to, looking in the past, it's, gosh, if I wish I was this way or should have been that way, then I would have been worthy of receiving mercy. Or even thinking of the future, I need to be this way for me to be worthy. But that's all accessible to me right now, just as it was back then, and just as it will be in the future, and that I can actually put forth that mercy in time, body, work, in either direction, and in right now, and that it's not based on any kind of conditions. That really just landed for me deeply tonight reading that.
Yes, amen. Mercy is without conditions. Bless you as you take that in.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel, and thank you, Melba, and thank you, Jack and Jackie, and Tamara, and David, and our first sharing was, that's too many names to remember, but bless you all and your sharing, and we just hold you in gratitude for helping us take in these ideas. And now it is our great joy to listen again to the teaching of Robin Bloor, a friend in the work in our community and a dear one, beloved of God. And thank you, Robin, for your willingness to lead us through this extraordinary subject of time and being present in the now. Bless you as you lead us. Thank you.
Thank you for that introduction, Peter. I'm very pleased to be here. Let me try and get the technology working. It So can everybody see this presentation?
Yeah. Yes, if you maximize that image it, or put it on slide view. There you go. Perfect.
Right, okay. There is, if there's any overall message that comes out of this, it is that there are different qualities of now. And in my opinion, it's through my experience, if you like. In my opinion, the very act of the crucifixion is in some way or other a depiction of now. So in a sense, that's the theme of this presentation. So I'm going to talk about, or I'm going to meander through is probably the thing, several different topics. First, the idea of the times of our life. The idea of the cross, the symbol of the cross, and what it means specifically to me. I'm going to relate the parable of the angry monk. And then just one comment on the sorrow of Gurdjieff. And then I'm going to walk through the Stations of the Cross, the Way of Sorrow. And final comment, not peace, but a sword. So this is something that Peter Uspensky said, and in my opinion, it's entirely true. We just don't look at it this way. Time does not flow any more than space flows. It is we who are flowing. So this is where we begin. We're programmed from an early age to perceive time as a line. Our inner model, the way we conceive of the world, is actually a barrier in the work. So we have this little diagram on the right here, conception, birth, death, and we stand on something that, well, we can call it now. And we can look back to the past and forward to the future. This is just the standard way it's thought about. And it's difficult to think of, it's not easy to think in other ways, because this is reinforced by the idea of the order of events and so on. There's a common agreement about this. However, the truth is that our subjective experience of time varies according to the level of attention, according to our presence. Put simply, the total of moments of presence in someone's life varies considerably. Indeed, it could be said in the case of many people that they have almost no presence in the whole of their lives. And this is what Gurdjieff refers to when he draws attention to the ever-shortening life of man. It's not shortening in the way that we measure time. It's shortening if we measure time in respect of attention. So this brings me to what I initial, this was the initial understanding, or if you like, the initial picture that presented itself to me when, for one reason or another, the cross became a very powerful symbol for me. We are nailed by our accumulation of associations to the past. We are nailed to the future by our expectations and our fears and our naive hopes. We are nailed by our life, by our imagination about our life, which prevents us from seeing our reality. We don't live our lives, we imagine them. Those are the three nails of the cross. The only possible ascension is through changes of state. It's to rise in state. to go from world 96 to world 48 to world 24 to world 12. And in my opinion, this is one of the things that Christ demonstrated with his crucifixion. So we have the parable of the angry monk. There were two monks who lived together at a monastery. One of the monks, the obedient monk, was dedicated to his observations of the daily rituals of the monastery. He was diligently obedient, polite in behavior, and devout in prayer. The other monk, the angry monk, was forever angry. He cursed God in every way he knew how. He berated God for every mishap that punctuated his day. When he wasn't complaining to others about God, he muttered criticism of God under his breath. And then one day, the angry monk was suddenly transformed. His anger disappeared and he became saintly. And the obedient monk came to him and said, "Why you? You who cursed God with every breath, you who criticized God, you who berated God, why did he choose you?" And the angry monk replied, "He was always in my mind." Madame de Saltzman tells of an incident late in Gurdjieff's life when she came upon him in a place in Switzerland. He was sitting looking very sad and discouraged. She asked him, "Are you discouraged because we are not working hard enough? Is there something we don't do?" With great feeling, he described his sadness as he conveyed to her the immense distance between what was needed and what was being done. He felt compassion for his pupils as well as his inability to do it for them. Then he waved to her to go and play the piano. So this is the way of sorrow. The first station of the cross, Jesus on the Mount of Olives. Jesus prays on the Mount of Olives for his Father to take the cup from his hand. We all have one within us who would shirk their fate. The second station of a cross, Jesus is betrayed by Judas and arrested, betrayed by one whom he trusted. We all have an inner Judas. The third station of the cross, Jesus is condemned by the Sanhedrin. Within us too, there is a Sanhedrin council with many important members and a high priest. They fear to lose their place. Christ challenges them to do so. The fourth station of the cross, Peter denies Jesus. How is Peter any different to our Judas? And yet on this rock. The fifth station of the cross, Jesus is judged by Pontius Pilate. And he took water and washed his hands. At the birth of Christ, everyone gathers, Mary and Joseph, the three kings, the shepherds with their sheep. This is symbolically the birth of the Kesjan body, a virgin birth. At the crucifixion of Christ, everyone draws away. Judas betrays, Peter denies, the Sanhedrin condemn, and Pontius Pilate washes his hands. This is the birth of the soul. It is a way of sorrow. The sixth station of the cross, Jesus is scourged and crowned with thorns. to me, the scourging of the body indicates mastery of the body. To me, the crown of thorns symbolizes the abandoning of the normal mind. Seventh station of the cross, Jesus takes up his cross. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. To take up the cross is to choose to die to what one is. The eighth station of the cross, Simon of Cyrene helps Jesus carry his cross. Simon of Cyrene is ordered to do so by the Roman soldiers. This is the interval in the octave. This is the point at which Christ needed help. But it wasn't help that was volunteered. It was help that was commanded. Within us, there are those who would at least help to carry the cross. The ninth station of the cross, Jesus meets the women of Jerusalem and some disciples. Jesus cautions them that they should not weep for him, but that their concerns should be for themselves and the lives of their children. In effect, he commands them not to try to give him any help whatsoever. The tenth station of the cross, Jesus is nailed to the cross. The crucifixion now happens, but he has not arrived without considerable suffering, and it will not end without considerable pain. The 11th station of the cross, Jesus promises his kingdom to the just thief. There are parts of us that need to die and parts that are just that can be saved. One on the right, one on the left. The 12th station of the cross, Jesus on the cross speaks with his mother and disciples. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciples standing by whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her unto his own home. There's a mystical meaning to that. The 13th station of the cross, Jesus dies. 30 years Jesus grew, studied, learned, foresaw. 3 years Christ ministered. What teachings, healings, miracles, communion with the multitude, preparation of his disciples. 3 months from the going up to Jerusalem until the end. Faster, faster, matter is stirred. Tighter, tighter is time compressed. 3 days of his passion, each minute, each second, intent with agony and creation. 3 hours upon the cross. And behold, the veil of the temple was split in twain. Time split, past, present, above and below were fused. And in those hours, a whole great age of man's development was formed. This is the creation of now. The final station of the cross, Jesus is laid in the tomb. But Mary stood without at the sepulchre weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the sepulchre and seeth two angels in white sitting, the one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. And they say unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? She saith unto them, Because they have taken away my Lord, and I know not where they have laid him. And when she had thus said, she turned herself back and saw Jesus standing, and knew not that it was Jesus. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou? She, supposing him to be the gardener, saith unto him, Sir, if thou hast borne him hence, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away. Jesus saith unto her, Mary. She turned herself and saith unto him, Rabboni, which is to say, Master. Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things unto her. I'm now going to give you some examples of now, examples which were delivered by teachers. And if you want in any way to characterize this, then you can characterize it with these words, think not that I come to send peace on earth. I come not to send peace, but a sword. Madame de Saltzman is gathering some of the people in Rina's group, along with other people who were in London, went to a gathering where they would be able to meet with Madame de Saltzman and she would answer questions about the work. They were all sitting on the floor, which was typical at that particular time. And Madame de Saltzman walked into the room and she looked. That's a man that I happen to know who told me about this, called Carlton. She looked at him and she pointed at him and she said, you're not present. She created now for that man. Rina Hans at the dinner table, this happened more than once where someone would ask a question, she would answer it. And someone else, perhaps on the other side of the table, perhaps at the other end of the room, would burst out crying. And everybody knew that she had spoken to two people at once. During the summer week, Rina Hans, there was a woman who by the time 3 or 4 days had gone by in that Holy Week would become hysterical. Rina was in the kitchen with a fair few other people from the work. They were doing stuff in terms of cooking. And this woman just became intolerably hysterical. And Rina turned around and slapped her hard across the face. And she created now for everybody present. And she knew she could do that. And finally, a story I heard recently from Susanna. Rina Hans was talking to a pupil. She was sitting down at a table with him. And the pupil quite clearly had got tied up in himself. And she slapped her hand down on the table and said, now. And he came straight into the moment. She had created now for him. This is not peace, but a sword. If anybody would like to ask questions then, or offer opinions. Money.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Robin, I want to say thank you for that. One of the things, and there is a lot to process there. That's going to take me a long time. I'm going to have to watch it again, work through it. A lot there. Thank you. But one thing that I have been considering a lot and observing in myself how fatal comfort is, and in terms of self-satisfaction, feeling comfortable, and how that's there are many eyes in me that desire comfort. And I really appreciate this idea, connecting. I didn't come to bring peace. I came to bring a sword as kind of a goad to help me remember that when I fall asleep in with those eyes that do desire to be comforted, that the sword can wake me up. And I've never seen that statement of Jesus isn't that light at all. So I appreciate your perspective, bringing that a new way of looking at what he had to say. It's always kind of disturbed me, but I love this interpretation. So thank you.
So there is, I mean, you are quite right. And it's an extremely important point to make that our mechanical selves, when we have no attention whatsoever, they always, I mean, my experience anyway, they always choose comfort. And there is a warning that came from Rena Hans also, that you can't work all day. You can't do the work all day. So there are times when you just let the machine do its thing. You know, you watch pathetic programs on television or whatever, or you kind of vanish into yourself or whatever. The mistake of not struggling with yourself is what happens with an awful lot of people in the work, because they have created an image of themselves that they are working on themselves, and maybe at one point in time that was true, but it kind of ceases to be true, and they have imagination, they have fantastic stories about working on themselves. They turn up at meetings and they start to tell how they did this and how they did that. And those people who are capable of detecting lies as they trip off people's tongues, stay silent, you know, because what are you going to say? But there's another warning, which is not to become, it's what Rena Hans described as the fast motorbike to hell, which is not to try and work 16 hours a day, because you'll burn yourself out. So there is a balance. Julie.
Hi, everyone. I wanted to comment and hear more of your comments about the angry monk parable, because I have to admit, at first I didn't get it. And as you continue talking in this idea of the of now and this sort of time concept, that idea of that time doesn't flow anymore. What was the quote? Time doesn't flow anymore than space flows. It's we who flow. And then I thought, well, that's the angry monk, and that it was God that was always, there's just something there. And I'd love to hear more of your thoughts about that parable.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the essence of the parable is it's a parable of the work. I mean, there's no question that this is a parable of the work. And the essence of the parable is that if you kind of understand, let's say, the scientific side of the work, to be in a state and to be in a negative state is actually to be using a much higher, well, a significantly higher energy than the energy of mechanism. It's higher. And the idea that one person could focus around a particular image they have would be the image of the absolute in this instance, but that you could focus around it, you live your life around it. That's a very, very different existence to the existence of, which is what probably happens in most monastic situations, of just in one way or another going into a kind of comfort. This man was never comfortable. And the other thing, which is, I really can't, I mean, I shouldn't speak too in too much detail about it, but the second conscious shock is the transformation of negative emotion. That's what it is. The reason that in the work that we are told at the very beginning to not express negative emotion is so we become very, very familiar with it. We become familiar with it because we have to keep it bottled up inside in lots of situations. We have to find ways of dealing with the fact that in one way or another we regard something that happened as cruel, unfair, whatever, you know, that was oppressive towards us. But that's just training for when we start to experience a very strong negative emotion and we find the means to transform it. And you can't do that without self-remembering. Or if you do, it's likely to damage the individual, which is why the work proceeds in the way it does. We begin with self-remembering and then we move on to the idea of the transformation of negative emotion. And we're practicing for that all along with the non-expression of negative emotion. I may have confused you, but that's what I've got to say. Roland.
You said that there was a mystical meaning when Jesus commends his mother to the disciple he loves and vice versa. I was curious about what that means, what the mystical meaning was.
Well, for the disciple to accept Christ's mother as his mother, right, which, because in flesh and blood terms, she isn't. But you see, for every Christ, there has to be a mother of Christ. There are two really important women that, of course, for many, many years in the Christian church, they suppressed. They didn't want to give them too much importance. But, you know, Mary Magdalene and Mary, Mother of Christ, are incredibly important. In order to be able to be the womb in which, let's say a prophet was conceived and born, you have to be incredibly close to perfect. And so, that, just my perspective, the disciple taking Mary as his mother is an aspiration to become Christ. That's how I see it. It's it's very difficult to explain things in normal words that don't really admit a simple explanation. We're so used to the idea that someone will logically explain to us something. One of the things that's almost impossible for me to explain is the nature of resonance. I use the term resonance because it's the only term I can think of that'll help. But if you create within yourself You create something, and you might only be doing this with your primitive understanding of the nature of Christianity and your primitive understanding of the nature of the crucifixion. But if you can play the right note within yourself, even within the intellectual center, it will resonate. It will create harmonics at a much higher level. And something else will inform you. You know, the intellect at its best, and of course it's very regarded as very impressive in our society, but at its best, the intellect is the driver of the carriage. And the higher emotional center is the master that sits in the carriage. And in order to make the master that sits in the carriage manifest, the only mechanism I know of is resonance. You have to try and be something as pure as can be at a lower level. And if you get close to it, you'll invoke the higher. And somehow we all know this, or we wouldn't be where we are. We would never join these gatherings. We would never do anything like this. We know when we're praying, what are we doing? We're creating a noise, a sound, a musical note to try and stimulate some resonance from a higher level. We're trying to be the channel for something much higher than we are. I don't know if that makes sense. I'm doing my best. Rachel.
Hey, Robin, could you say more about, you said to you, so your interpretation, I'm taking that as, is the mastery over the body with the crown of thorns on Christ's head, as well as something around the, I don't know if you said mastery or something around the normal mind. I just was wondering.
Yeah, I can kind of elaborate on that. Well, there are a number of, let's say, processes, if you like, that are can be talked about symbolically, but that are in one way or another associated with the perfection of an individual. And these things happen to Christ symbolically, but the flaying of Christ is really no different from a kind of mystical perspective as the fight between St. George and the dragon, because it's the body that has to be in one way or another mastered. So in the original legend of St. George and the dragon, St. George doesn't kill the dragon. St. George defeats the dragon and leaves it by a silver cord. So this is one of the things that it has to be, in order to get a balanced individual, a man number four, that has to be done, is that the body has to become subservient. It has to be willing to be subservient. So I take the flaying of Christ to indicate that. I might be wrong. There may be a better interpretation than that. But the crown of thorns is just, to me, completely clear. The thing that happens for people that become involved in their own spiritual growth is that they create an imposter, their normal mind, that pretends to, let's say, do the work, that pretends to pray, that pretends in one way or another to occupy the genuine position of the genuine adherent. And there's nothing for that, but it has to be tortured out of its position. And you probably don't want to hear that. It's when in the work, when the word false personality is used, most people think, well, okay, there's a bit of me that's not kind of, if you like, well constructed. No, false personality is the story you've told yourself about yourself to convince yourself that you're something that you're absolutely not. That's what false personality is. And the crown of thorns is to impale completely false personality. That's how I see it. Again, you know, for me, the whole of the crucifixion is just, I mean, I had difficulty presenting this without the inherent emotion coming through, because for me, the whole of the crucifixion is utterly emotional. And what I'm doing now, if you like, is giving you logical explanations to things, but it's not logical at all. I didn't see that by working it out. I just felt it. I felt it in, if you like, in my vision of the crucifixion. So, James.
Thank you, Robin. I just wanted to say that the quote, "A time does not flow any more than space flows and is we that are flowing," that is incredibly helpful for me. It just taking that on just helps me to feel more grounded in my body in the eternal now. And it just also softens my sort of rigid sense of self too. It makes it feel more fluid. So that was just a really powerful quote for me. So thanks for sharing that.
Well, I'm pleased that it has meaning for you. When I first came to the work, the first real genuine teacher in the work that I came across was a guy called Tia Albrecht, who used to run a group with Adam Knott, who was C.S. Knott's son. And he asked me, you know, because I was saying I'd be interested in becoming part of your group, perhaps, if you'll tell me about it. He asked me, what is it that you want? And the question that I had and the question that I'd never actually properly articulated to anybody else is, I want to know what I am. I don't know what I am. And this quote from Uspensky just indicates that, you know, our view or our vision of what's actually going on is what I am isn't still. What I am isn't constant. You know, and it's much easier to see in those ideas. You know, with that idea that you're flowing through time and space, you just got on this course through time and space. And the question is, what's connected to you? What's going anywhere? What belongs to you? Is there anything that belongs to you? What do you know? What do you actually know? And that just, the Uspensky quote, which I just think is terribly beautiful, just raises that for me, raises those questions. Guy.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Being a man from Liverpool, as you are, I like it when you say the work warms my heart. Anyway, I wanted to see if you could comment on this. When you said you asked the question, you know, why did you want to join the group? What do you want? And I listened.
You're frozen. I can't really answer that. It wasn't completed.
That you taught.
Could you repeat? Because I didn't quite hear what you said.
From the beginning?
Yeah, please.
When your gentleman asked you what that you wanted to get from joining the group, you gave your answer, I wanted to know what I am. What came to me from my answer for that question is what I would want. Crucifixion came to mind. Like I want the work to crucify me because I don't know who I am. I have this imagination of who I think I am. It's nonsense. And I just wondered if you could elaborate on that.
Well, it is the invitation from Christ to take up the cross. And he's serious. You know, he's demonstrated. You see, there are various things. You could say some of them are mystical, and you could say maybe some of it is just church propaganda and so on and so forth. But it wasn't Christ that was crucified. It was Christ that was crucified on behalf of humanity to show them the way. That's, you know, how I look at it. And therefore, if you join the work and what you want is crucifixion, if you understand crucifixion in that way, then yes, you want to understand the nature of suffering. You want to understand the nature of reality, not the pleasant dreams that you create for yourself at various points in time that speak only to a pretend reality. You want to see it as it is. And by the way, insofar as anybody has noted down what that is, the word, you know, ultimately the word bliss is what normally arises. You know, there is a painful path, but it's a path to bliss. So, Peter.
Your examples of Rena Hand's teaching were vivid and powerful. I'm wondering if you could provide us context of who Rena Hand was and who Rena was to you.
Well, those are two very different things. Rena Hands was originally a pupil of Peter Uspensky. So she was part of Peter Uspensky's group. She'd done a degree in English literature at London University. And when she came out of the university, or possibly while she was still there, she became part of the Bloomsbury set. But at the time Peter Uspensky stepped up, people like T.S. Eliot and W.H. Auden and D.H. Lawrence and people like that joined Uspensky's group. And so she did. And some of them never stayed long, it has to be said. But, you know, she did. And then after a period of time, she became secretary to John G. Bennett. So a number of the books that Bennett is the author of, she is the editor of, she put together. She was his right hand in terms of publishing for a long time. And then at the end of the war, when Bennett discovered that Gurdjieff was still alive and living in Paris, she went to Paris and became a pupil of Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff told her to become the movement's teacher. So she then became a pupil of Jean de Saltzman. And after Gurdjieff died and she came back to the UK, she was part of Jane Heap's group. And then she formed a group with Madame Knott, Rosemary Knott, and John Bennett and herself. And Bennett left because he fell out with the Gurdjieff Foundation in Paris. So she ended up, that's how a group came to be. I joined that group way later than when it was formed. I joined that group in about 1988. And she was my teacher for 6 years. Unforgettable person because, you know, in one way or another, she would say, and quite accurately, she would say, I'm just a little old lady. And, you know, a lot of the time she was just a little old lady, just doing what, you know, the Rena Hans little old lady did. And then at other times, she would shock you. You would find yourself maneuvered into situations that were fundamentally difficult for you, perhaps embarrassing, perhaps you just didn't have the skill to manage such a situation. And she would know, and she'd send you there. You know, you thank her. Because I don't know where else you get teaching like that. I really don't. Jeff.
Hi, Robin. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little more when you spoke of the crucifix and Jesus Christ on the cross with the crown being fire and the fire of Christ and sitting right above his head, Inri, there is the esoteric interpretation of Inri that I've read. In nature, fire burns incessantly. I was wondering if you could take those three parts of the fire and elaborate on that.
I'm not sure I can do what you want, but I mean, first of all, the Inri thing means King of the Jews. The and a lot of people, this comes from me, right? The Jews, if you like, genetically, are a race that were in one way or another severely damaged by the Romans and scattered across Europe and the Middle East. But symbolically, the Jews are man number four. They have nowhere to rest their head. And that for 2,000 years, they were man number four. They were symbolic of man number four. And you saw what happened to them in various places at various points in time. There was a huge discrimination against them. And so they suffered. And mostly they suffered in silence until that incredibly brutal mass murder by the Nazis. They just suffered in silence. And for me, they have, you know, that Christ represents the suffering of man number four. He's not there for man number one, two, or three, because man number one, two, or three doesn't want any. Now, in terms of the fire, you know, all of the high energies that surround the human being are of the nature of fire. So when we talk about earth, water, air, and fire as the four elements, the domain of fire belongs to man at the lowest level, the angels at the next level, and the archangels at the next level. That's the world of fire. And so there is almost, I mean, there are a whole series of, I don't know, basically almost coincidental I've seen written somewhere, I take my place at the center of the sun, as words of Christ. And it's exactly correct. He is the fire. He is the fire on earth in that sense. So there's all I'm doing, by the way, is just walking around and saying things. I'm not trying to coherently put all of this stuff together, because you've asked a question that I don't, that all I can do is to bring what I've got, basically. I don't know if that helps. Janet?
Hi, thank you so much. And I came in a little bit late. So if this question I ask is, I hope I'm not asking something that was said and explained, but I'm wondering, you just said that man number four, you know, you referenced it as, you know, Jesus or someone who has nowhere to rest their head. I'm wondering what you mean by that, or whether you could just elaborate on that idea of not, of, you know, what you mean by that in terms of the man not being able to rest his head as number four, man number four.
Well, I mean, it's also said, there are different ways of looking at this, but it's also said that once you become part of the work, you leave a comfortable chair, and you haven't got to the place you want to go to, which is man number five. So the position of man number four is that he has nowhere to sit. He can't go back. He poisoned himself by discovering too many things about his own nature. So he can't go back to where he was. So he has no choice but to go forward. And this, again, speaks to power. It speaks to the idea of fire, because it's the fire that will take him there. Or her, by the way. Brian.
Hi, Robin, everyone. I just wanted to make a comment on the angry monk. And when I heard that, I think it ended with saying that God was always in my mind. And what I took from that was that God had me into his heart and I was in the wrong place. So maybe I'm saying it another way that you've already stated, or maybe I've got it wrong, but I just wanted to state that.
Sorry, can you repeat it? You came over quite kind of staccato, and I didn't quite catch everything you were saying. Could you repeat, please? You're going to have to unmute.
God had moved to his heart from his mind.
Sorry, you were muted for most of that. Try again. Okay.
I'll try again on another day.
Oh.
I was saying that I thought that God had moved from his mind to his heart.
Oh, well, there's no question. There isn't. It's one of those things that if you're going to if you're going to transform something in the emotional center, at the high level of the emotional center, it's not going to happen in the mind. The mind can't do anything like that. It might be very clever at playing, I don't know, poker or chess or bridge or whatever. It might, you know, it might have a natural talent for manipulating mathematical variables and making beautiful, pretty equations. But you see, I tell this to people, and it's hard to understand until perhaps after a period of time you've been in the work. But the truth of the matter is this: the intellectual center is just a function. That's all it is. And the lower emotional center, that's a function. And the moving center, that's a function. And that means that they are no different than, let's say, the liver or the spleen or the lungs or some other organ of the body. They are just organs, admittedly at a higher level, but they're just functions. And the mistake that we make as children, eventually leading to the whole of adulthood and everything, is we identify with these things and we think we are them. Well, you are no more your thinking center than you are your liver. It's just that there's no difference. So it has to be understood that the higher emotional center is where we are heading to, and the intellectual center can help to the extent that it becomes emotional. So thanks for that. Thanks for the question. Lauren.
I'm curious, Robin, what you think about when you were talking about the functions. What do you think, if it's a function, the function of dreams are? And what center, if any, do they come from?
No, so that's a multi-layered question, because the domain of dreams while you're asleep we call them dreams. It's one of these problems that we have. If you use a word to describe things that are different from each other, then they're all classified as dreams. And I, for instance, had a dream, which it wasn't a reality. I know it wasn't a reality, but it had such a mystical twist to it that I was floating above the street in the house that I lived, and there were just cats everywhere. And I have no idea where that came from, but that wasn't a normal dream. Most of the dreams that you're having are the unwinding of the emotional center within the essence to absorb the bruises of the day, if there were any bruises in the day. Sometimes the dreams are unwinding the bruises of the past. And so on. So there's a certain kind of healing activity that's going on. These centers in sleep, the centers disconnect from each other. And there is normally, it's very, very rare that all three centers will connect while you're sleeping. Normally, you can get two centers connecting. When you have to understand that the moving center is the place where the images are created. The intellectual center is a place where the words are created. And the emotional center is the place where the mood is created, is possibly the best thing to say. So one way of going to sleep is to settle them all down. So I've never had too much problem going to sleep. If you want to go to sleep, start by setting the intellectual center counting, and that'll stop it doing anything else. Get the moving center to create an image of a time when you were very comfortable and felt very safe. It could be lying, I don't know, on the grass in an open field on a sunny day, lying by the beach, just actually lying in your cot when you were a small child and felt safe, whatever. Just send it that image. And that'll quieten down the emotional center. And just breathe. Well, you'll stop breathing easily. You'll be asleep very, 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 very quickly because you've gone and used these functions in that way. But at some time, of course, something may happen. Now, there are various mystical things that you can do that occur in dreams. If you were to say that all the psychotropic substances that are used mostly by teenagers, they in actual fact appear to, as far as I can tell, they appear to engage, they appear to make connections that engage a dreaming function. And so you get sometimes accidental connections. People who take something and believe that they've seen God in one way or another, it may well have been that they've seen something very high. But you see, they're distorting their normal mechanisms, so it's very difficult to say anything in truth about them, but those are dreams. And you can also catch yourself dreaming during the day, but you don't think of them as dreams. So there's an important visit. Let's say it's a visit to the dentist. I hate the dentist. I've never liked the dentist. Don't even like my dentist, but he's better the devil you know than the devil you don't or something. And you have imagination on your way to the dentist. You have imagination about what the experience is going to be like. And it never, ever resembles the experience you actually have. So it's quite clear. It's just fantasy. And we do that. In fact, it's said like this. It's as a general principle in the work. There are three big problems. And every individual will have one of these problems worse than the other two. One of them is negative emotions. Some people are just driven insane by their negative responses that they learned when they were young. And the second one is imagination. They can't live in reality. They just want to create imagination about everything that's going on. This is, you know, false personality on steroids, I guess. And the third is formatory thinking. The thinking center doesn't work at all. And all their opinions are just repetitions of things they heard from somebody else. And with which they may even pretend to be wise. But those three are the three major problems. And each one of us has one of those as a bigger problem than the other one. With me, it was imagination.
Thank you, Robin, for your teaching and for blessing us with that enriching knowledge and being that you bring to us. It's a gift to share this night with you and enter into the Holy Week season with these images and this awareness that you brought forward to us. Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure for me to address this assembly. It gives me so much hope. I mean, there is really quite a large number of you.
Yeah. Thank you for being among us and being with us tonight and again in the future. Well, friends, we'll conclude our evening again with the prayer of confidence, taking these things deeply into our hearts, however they landed for you tonight. Remembering the truth together that God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed we are to simply remember God. May Almighty God grant us each a peaceful night and a quiet death. And a piercing death of the self, so to be raised to new life. Amen.